Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday.
And that's the best that clip goes.
Are you there?
I could do that if you like.
All right, you're there. You're in.
I am.
I'm getting you here. Are you getting it? Looks like you're getting out the board, too. I've got the ins and the outs right.
Well done, Steve. It is Saturday, the 26th day of July, Anno Domini 2025. And you possibly lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, for your edification and delectation, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Before we get to the news, let me call out Steve Ray, both good and bad. I'm working from home today for two reasons. One is I had gel shots in my knees, and while they are better, they are not yet good. And I get this multiple sheets of paper. First page says it'll take 2 or 3 days for the thing to go down. And I said, okay, 2 or 3 days, I can deal with that. Then I look more closely. The first page says 2 or 3 days before any reaction at the injection site goes down. You get to the last page, and it says it can take 2 or 3 weeks for the gel shots to actually take effect. Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
What can you give me?
But then last week at the show, Steve was kind enough to share his cold with me. So I thought it would be best not to give it back. So I'm working from home today.
Where's this?
But in the meantime.
And I'm only the board op.
And you're only the board op, so really, who cares what you think?
Thank you.
Yeah, we know you can shut us all down at a moment's notice. If you do that, then you're in charge. And I can go back to bed. That'll be good. All right, so Microsoft is now offering a free year's extension to Windows 10. Okay, it's understandable if you're a bit confused. Originally, Microsoft said that under no circumstances would you be allowed to keep Windows 10. Then it said you could pay an increasing premium to keep Windows 10 for up to 3 years. Then it said you could have Windows 10 for just one more year if you paid $30 for it. Then it said you could send in 3 box tops and 1 thin dime to get another. No, hold on. That was for a square foot of land in the Yukon from Sergeant Preston. Anyway, starting on Tuesday, Microsoft is now saying that it's official. What the hell? You can have Windows 10 for free for another year. Windows 10 is the faster, better, safer, sexier option with whiter teeth that Microsoft wants the 700 million Windows 10 holdouts to move to. But Microsoft now says, we understand that moving to a new PC can take time, and we're here to support you throughout the process, as long as it doesn't take more than another year. Or to put it another way, we give up. In a Tuesday blog post, Microsoft said, starting today, individuals will begin to see an enrollment wizard through notifications and in settings, making it simple to select the best option for you and enroll in ESU directly from your personal Windows 10 PC. While the U-turn to the free 10-month security update extension has been reported as including a catch, that just means you need to pick one of Microsoft options, using OneDrive, for example, or some of your rewards points. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, but it wasn't official. It wasn't in the notification section or in the settings, and now it is. It's essentially a free offer, or, of course, you can pay the $30. Many of you will have already seen the notification pop up, and I'm sure once you've got your heart started again, couldn't click on it fast enough. For the rest of you, you can start impatiently staring at the notification icon in your taskbar or start frantically searching through settings. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Microsoft confirms free Windows update. Your choices are, I literally broke down and cried. Well, it's about dang time. I've already got it. I'm searching for it now. And even free Windows is too expensive. So far, your choices are not shockingly centered around even free Windows is too expensive. It's got well over half the votes. And, of course, you can vote in the poll by going to soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And, of course, you can join the fun here by giving us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Like I said, a couple of weeks ago, Microsoft was talking about this, but it wasn't official. It wasn't actually in the notifications. It wasn't part of the settings. Now it is, which means you don't have to go somewhere special to get it. You don't have to write down a URL somewhere. You just have to click on a link in your actual, excuse me, in your actual settings or notifications and do it right from there. And again, there's multiple ways to do it. You can pay the $30. You can save all of your settings to OneDrive, assuming they fit in 5 gig. Or you can use some of your Microsoft Rewards points. How do you get Microsoft Rewards points? The easiest way is to do searches in Bing. How do I put this politely? Nobody said they have to be legitimate searches. You can spend about 20 minutes searching the most random, bogus nonsense you like and rack up enough points to get a free copy of Microsoft Windows 10 for another year. It's not another copy. It's an extension of your license. So if you already got 10 in your machine, it just extends it for another year. So if you go to Bing and you do searches with Bing, you start racking up points, and you have to have, I forget what the number is, 1,000 points or 10,000 points, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't take long to get there, and once you do, you get your free bunch of stuff.
I'm up to 1,800 points on since I installed Bing last week.
Congratulations. It like I said, it's not difficult. You do, you know, just search. Search for anything. Who cares? If you're too young to remember Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, search for him. Search for the little scandal when they sold everybody in the world the same square foot of the Yukon for 10 cents and 3 boktops. I had that. I got that. I got my 10 cents. Sending my 10 cents, my 3 boktops. I got a certificate for a square foot of the Yukon. So it was very exciting.
Have you ever visited it?
Shockingly, I have not. I suspect it's somewhere on the side of a mountain. Nobody said that it was a horizontal foot.
Yep.
But, yeah. So if you do a lot of searches in Bing, you'll be good.
Oh, it was a square inch, not a square foot.
Was it?
Yep.
I don't remember. Well, I was shorter then.
He bought it for $1,000 and sold 21 million deeds.
Yeah.
For one square inch.
Yep. At a dime a piece. It was a square inch. You're right.
Yeah. Due to $37 in back taxes, the land was repossessed by the Canadian government in 1965.
Wait, it was a Canadian inch?
Yeah.
Of course, the Yukon is in Canada. So I don't even own my inch anymore.
Nope.
Well, this is depressing.
The government repossessed it, and the company dissolved in 1966. And there's now a golf course.
Of course there is.
Yeah. I'm reading from Wikipedia. According to this day, Yukon officials still receive letters and calls about the deeds.
Well, but if it's a golf course, then that means it's probably horizontal.
Yeah.
It was a whole horizontal inch, so I'm in good shape. Or I would be in good shape if I still owned it, which apparently I do not. Wait, do I still have a claim?
No.
Guess what? It was repossessed.
Yep.
Well, that's depressing.
Sorry.
What's not depressing are the sort of answers you get from us when you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. People have been adamant about keeping Windows 10.
700 million, was it?
Sorry, go ahead.
700 million, was it?
Yeah, 700 million people don't want to move to Windows 11. Partially because they're reactionary old people, and they don't want to learn anything new. Notice I didn't say they can't learn anything new.
Yep.
I said they don't want to learn anything new. But the reality is that in another year,
we'll go through all this again.
Yeah, unless Microsoft caves again. They are going to have to do something one way or the other. And that machine they're running is going to be yet another year out of date to run Windows 11.
Yeah, just through attrition, some of those Windows 10 machines will die and get replaced by Windows 11.
That's Microsoft's hope.
Yep.
But out of 700 million?
10% maybe?
Maybe. Okay, so that in round numbers, that's still 70 million machines. That leaves still 630 million machines that aren't upgrading. And a certain number of those, at least, will move to Linux. There are people who are now really looking at Linux as an alternative. Because, again, it depends on, you've got a machine. It works perfectly. You don't need to buy new hardware. You just need software that runs on it efficiently. Your choices, you can buy a new machine, you can buy a Mac, you can buy a Chromebook, but if you don't want to spend money buying something new, your choices are Linux. Since you can't continue to run Windows 10, you won't run Windows 11, or you can't run Windows 11, your only choice is to move to Linux. And so there are people who are now looking at, you know, an old laptop, put Linux on it, see how it works, see how they feel about it. You know, we've said this many times, for 99% of all people, a Chromebook will do them fine. But if you already have a machine and you want to keep it running, Linux will do that. Because most people live in the browser. Right? Any games you play in the browser. You get your mail through the browser. You do your web searching through the browser. You do Facebook and other social media through the browser. All you need is access to a browser. And Linux comes with Firefox and Chrome and Brave and Vivaldi. And so, you know, you just pick the one you like, install it from your software store, if it's not already installed, and you're on your way. You're done. It's a done deal. And you're happily computing for free.
And even on basic Windows and Mac PCs, very few people install any extra software anyway.
Right.
They use the browser and the email client and the photo client that it comes with.
Right. And many people use Thunderbird. Thunderbird is on Linux. I'm using Thunderbird myself. Many people use Chrome or Firefox or Brave or Vivaldi. All of those are available on Linux. And all of them are installable for free from the software center or software store or a software repository, whatever your particular version of Linux calls it.
You open Edge to download Chrome, and it says, no, wait, you don't need to do that. I'm great, too.
Yep. Yep, whereas with Linux, it's like, okay, you want Chrome? Here's Chrome. We don't care. It's a hard sell. I get moving to a new operating system is a hard sell, and I don't care if that new operating system is Windows 11 or Linux or a Chromebook or a Mac. I don't care. It's a hard sell, and it's mainly because, how do I put this as politely as possible? People don't want to learn anything new. They're perfectly content doing today what they did yesterday, and having to learn a new way to do something is not in their purview right now. They don't want to be bothered with that. But it's going to become more and more necessary as time goes on. So at some point, pull up your pants, bite the bullet, whatever your metaphor is, and think about doing it. All right, Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, we got a caller from Don from Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Question about Linux. I'm a heavy Photoshop Lightroom user, and are those programs, can they be put on Linux, and do they work as robustly as they would on Windows 10 or 11?
There are a number of alternatives, and you can probably – I have not tried running it under Wine. Wine is a program that lets you run many Linux Windows programs under Linux. some kid – and I'm trying to see if I bookmarked it anywhere – some kid just published a Lightroom replacement that he wrote, and everybody is praising the living heck out of it.
Well, I'm more into Photoshop than I am into Lightroom, but I do use both. But Photoshop is one that I use. It's sophisticated capabilities, particularly with seeking and masking, which are essential for adjusting photographs on a piece-by-piece means.
Right. Yeah, so Photoshop itself doesn't run under Linux unless it works under Wine, and I'm looking up that. But there are several alternatives that are close enough to Photoshop that a lot of the people can use it instead of Photoshop.
One of the things you can try is a program called the GIMP. GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program. And it has an amazing number of features that are as powerful as the ones you will find in Photoshop. Now, the reality is that you have to learn it.
Yeah, it's that old learning curve thing. You are using a different program. And,
right.
And according to several places, Photoshop does run well under Wine. So Wine is, as Nick said, Wine is a program that lets you run Windows programs in Unix layers. So it would be the same Windows version of Photoshop you're used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing, we do a lot of correspondence using Word, of course, and am I correct in assuming that Linux will take Word or something that is very compatible with recipients of the correspondence we would be writing?
Sorry, I was blowing my nose. Yes, there is a program called... LibreOffice, which is a replacement for Office. It has a word processor, a spreadsheet, a presentation program, a database, everything you could want. It reads and writes Word documents and Excel documents and PowerPoint documents. In fact, I use it for most of my 20 years at RIT. I was the systems administrator for the College of Business. Everybody was on Microsoft Office except me, and nobody knew it. So I could read any document they sent me and write any document they you know, back to them without a problem.
Okay. Well, winding up, regarding the soon-to-be obsolescence of Windows 10, you mentioned billions of people who wish to continue to use it rather than switching to Windows 11. Any chance do you think that Microsoft might extend its coverage of that program for another year or so?
Anything is possible. We just saw them do it. They caved this time. Maybe they'll cave in another year, but the reality is it costs them money to cave. They have to maintain, at least minimally. Remember, you're not getting full support for Windows 10. You're getting security updates only. So if a new feature comes out or a better alternative or something comes out, you don't get it. You only get security features so that you don't get hit by viruses. That's all Microsoft is giving you. So you are falling farther and farther behind. And Microsoft is utterly uninterested in keeping you up to date. So the likelihood that they will continue to do this is very small.
If Microsoft has not done it already, do you expect that soon they will go to a monthly fee for the operating system?
Well, a yearly fee, certainly. Microsoft has been saying for years to their investors that what they want is a subscription model for Windows. You do not lie to your investors. You can lie to everybody else on the planet. You better not lie to your investors. So we don't know quite when that's going to happen, but it's no longer an if. It's a when. And the real question is, how much will they charge, and how much is that worth to you?
Right. Okay.
And it may kind of be what they've done with Microsoft Office now, is that the enterprise corporate versions of Microsoft Office and Azure and all the enterprise products all are already what's called seat-based. You pay per user per month. But there's still a home version of Microsoft Office on a flat one-time price. So they might do that so that Windows in corporations is a monthly fee, but people on home PCs is a one-time fee. But we don't know.
Right. They've got a lot of choices. We don't know. Simple enough.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for letting me know what you do know, particularly in view of Photoshop Lightroom not being immediately and transparently transferable to Linux. That would certainly weigh in, but I've got some old computers that I might try Linux on, and you simply say that you can download it to a jump drive or whatever, and then uninstall Windows 7 and reinstall the Linux on the same machine. As simple as that, right?
Well, yeah, what you do is you download it. You have to use a program that will create a bootable jump drive. You then boot with that jump drive, and one of the choices you get is to try it, because it's a live CD, but it's going to be a slow live CD. Or you can say replace Windows entirely with Linux. Just hit a button and wait. All right, we got to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Well, Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I apologize. I had muted my microphone, and because I'm from home, it's in an entirely different place than I expected it, and suddenly I was an old man wandering around the screen looking for it. I do want to point out before we get back to the phones that although this is entirely Steve Ray's fault, he's done an exceptional job getting me involved, even though I'm working from home today. And he's managed to connect me up and put me in the YouTube and over the air and everything else from home. It's just excellent work. Excellent work. Dr. Ray, very well done. And now back to the phones. Our next caller is Bill from Grace, New York. Welcome, Bill. What's up?
Good afternoon. First, an answer and then a question. For the photographer that was calling in, you can't really use GIMP because a good photographer will take pictures in a RAW format and a JPEG because RAW offers better editing, and GIMP does not edit RAW photos. However, there is a program called Darktable, and that's a multi-platform program. You can run it on Linux, Mac, and Windows, and he can download Darktable to his Windows program and see if that's sufficient for him. It's a very high-end program created by engineers, so it is technical. You can do raster masking, you can do luminosity masking, you can do parametric masking. It's a beautiful program to use. Okay,
perfect. Thank you.
On my question, I just bought a 4K monitor, and I suddenly discovered the problem of scaling. So when I first look at it, everything is so small, I can't see anything. So it looks to me like I have two choices. One is to download the resolution to like a 1920 by 1080, or the other one is to scale up. And I'm wondering what is the best solution. Is it one, the other, or to use a little bit of both?
My personal solution was to just make the text bigger. You know, you can go into
icons, and you've got all kinds of other things that are scary.
Right, right. So you can make your icons bigger. You can make your text bigger. You can make, you know, any of the elements of your user interface bigger. And I made those larger so that they were bigger on the screen, but I still had all that real estate.
If your video card is capable of it, there is a feature called High DPI, which basically uses 4 pixels per dot. So it takes your 4096 4K image and makes it look like a 2048 2K resolution, but you're getting 4K worth of dots. So you are getting a higher quality image. It basically makes the screen look twice as big by using more dots per pixel.
Are you on Windows or Linux or what?
I'm on Windows and 4 Linux on one machine because I've got 6 hard drives.
Congratulations. All right. Again,
my solution has been to just scale up like 150%, and that seems to do it. But sometimes some lettering gets a little fuzzy. And then I tried dumping down to 1920, but that didn't seem to be as good. So I thought maybe there was a mix, like to drop down to 28 or something, and then to increase your scaling to 125. But I couldn't find an answer to that on the Internet.
Yeah, well, the best solution is to leave your resolution where it is.
The native resolution of the display.
The native resolution of the display. And to go into the appearance, for example, in one of your Linuxes.
Yeah.
And in there, you can change the size of the font for example, window titles or menus.
Yeah, there's usually about 6 different settings on fonts. I usually bump them up, every one of them, bump them up too.
And it's mostly trial and error to see if that's, you know, which one works the best for you.
I was hoping maybe there was a magic formula.
No, I wish there's no magic. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. And in the future, if somebody's asking about photography, tell them to try Darktable, and they can load it on any platform to try it out.
Darktable, excellent. Good to know. Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
I posted it to our link list as well.
Darktable.org. There you go. Ooh. Ooh. Looks good.
Hey, Will, how are you doing down there?
Sorry. I was just pretty impressed by it.
It's warm up here.
Yeah.
What did he say? Can't hear him.
Dave's getting a caller online.
Dave's getting a call. The good news is that Bill is a very accomplished photographer, and so his answer is going to be way more definitive than any of ours, and he is kind enough to call in. So thank you, Bill. So thank you. Who we got next?
Well, we have Will from Hampton, Virginia.
Hey, Will, what's up?
Oh, I'm living my best life, Nick. Notwithstanding, I think we have to go a little bit further and address the issue of the hard sell that you previously mentioned. As you know, Microsoft's pathological predisposition for protecting its licensing agreements with the manufacturers is legendary. And yet the real and most insidious stroke of genius was having made the kernel or operating system belligerent to the introduction of manufacturer-specific drivers. And I'm not necessarily talking about mainline manufacturers. I'm talking about the instance of me getting that Ace Magic that I mentioned last week. Because it's not a mainline manufacturer like Lenovo or Dell or HP, I've had a devil of a time trying to get it to replace the generic drivers with the manufacturer specific. So here's a chronological summary of everything between myself and Gemini that we've tried so far. Identified that the Ace Magic's laptop touchpad wasn't working after a fresh Windows install. Downloaded the official drivers from the Ace Magic's website, from the EU version, that is. Located the touchpad's hardware ID in Device Manager. We edited the HID_PCI-INF file to include that hardware ID. Fifth, we attempted to install the driver through Device Manager, but encountered a hash mismatch error. Six, we disabled the Windows driver signature enforcement and tried installing again. Seven, this time we got a code 10 error indicating a potential driver incompatibility. And that's the summary of things that I've tried thus far.
You're absolutely right about this, Will. The reality is that, how do I put this politely? Microsoft is consolidating more and more power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they have already said that you're better off getting your drivers from Microsoft than from the manufacturer. And they, let's put it politely, encourage you to do that.
And that, my friend, is the insidious genius of it.
And therefore, yes, I absolutely agree with you. Now, I will almost guarantee that if you were to try Linux on that machine, everything would work perfectly. I won't promise that because any out of bounds hardware could be a problem.
Yes, with this out-of-bounds hardware, Nick, that's exactly the problem I'm encountering with trying to dual boot. Even to insert the thumb drive, it's not recognizing it.
Generally, there when you insert a thumb drive, So in the BIOS, with many of these systems, they are set up so that you don't have the ability to just randomly boot something from the thumb drive. That's a security feature. You have to go in and turn that on. And then you have to hit some sort of key combination. F11, F12, F2, escape, control D, something that during the boot process that brings up the boot menu. And then you can pick which thing you want to boot from. But it has to be turned on in your BIOS.
Yeah, I did change the boot order. I did do that. And that's really how I encountered the problem, I believe. Yeah.
So you, well, yes. And you can change the boot order, which now means it tries to boot from the thumb drive first. If there is no thumb drive, then it boots from the hard drive. Right? Is that how you set it up?
Well, I'll tell you like this. As far as Windows 11 was concerned, there was no boot drive, even though I had the thumb drive plugged in, even though I had changed the boot order. As far as Windows 11 was concerned,
Well, that generally isn't a Windows 11 thing, because Windows 11 hasn't started yet. So you're saying when you go into the BIOS and set it up to boot from the thumb drive first and then from the hard drive, and then you plug in a thumb drive and restart and then save and exit, it doesn't read from the thumb drive?
I'm pretty confident that was exactly what happened. But just to make sure, after the boot process had completed, I got past the splash screens and got to the main Windows desktop. I checked the file manager, and come to find out, I don't see an external drive plugged in.
Okay, that's a separate issue. But when you created the bootable thumb drive, how did you do that?
I did it in first I made it an exFAT, okay? I made it an exFAT. Then I created the bootable thumb drive using a Linux ISO, using a Zorin ISO. And I did all of that in Linux.
And how did you do that in Linux? Did you just copy over the ISO, or did you use a program to do that?
No. I used ImageWriter. I used the native ImageWriter.
Okay. All right. Then it should be a bootable thumb drive.
It should be, Nick. It absolutely should be.
So either there's something else in the Ace Magic BIOS. It's got to be in the Ace Magic BIOS, because Windows doesn't take effect until after the BIOS has done its magic. So if it's not reading the thumb drive, then either the thumb drive is bad, or that particular USB port is turned off.
I'll tell you what I did to ensure that it was not the thumb drive. I took it out and plugged it into my Lenovo, and Lenovo saw Zorin OS Core 16.3.
Then the problem has got to be that your USB drive, if you plug a standard data drive into that machine, does it read it?
What I did was I made a Windows System Restore disk from Win 11, which the Ace Magic does recognize.
No. I want to know if it will read a standard data disk, a data thumb drive.
A standard data. Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get one that I know to be a standard data disk drive and plug it in. Hold on just a moment.
FAT32 or FAT16 is what it has to be if you're in Windows.
Okay, admittedly,
I don't know. I don't recall what I made this specific one that I'm about to plug in, but if I remember correctly, I think I did make it Fat 2 to Fat 32. Hold on.
Yep. See, that's if it's not recognizing it at all, then either it's a bad thumb drive, which is always a possibility, but you say you've looked at it in another machine and okay.
Yeah.
So it's probably not that. Or it's the port is turned off and for reading standard data drives. Excuse me, anything but a standard data drive.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to find out here in a minute. What it
right.
Doesn't TPM kind of possibly become involved there, where it prevents you from booting a non-signed OS?
You know what?
So you might have to turn that off, too.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, that might very well be the case, I think, because that, you know, TPM 2.0 is different from the legacy version of TPM.
Yep. Yep, you may have to turn off TPM 2.0. That's an excellent point, Steve.
I didn't think of that, Steve. Thank you.
Nor did I. Good point.
That's why you have multiple people, so someone's going to think of something.
Exactly. While I'm talking, Steve's thinking. While Steve's talking, I'm thinking. Trying to come up with something the other one hasn't said yet.
I tell you what, fellas, I may have to call you back later on this because my external mouse is acting a little bit wonky and I can't seem to. So I might have to call you back, all right?
The first thing you do is try turning off TPM and see if you can boot.
Yeah, I'm because until I can get this other thing going again, I'm not going anywhere. So I'll just call you back. Call you guys. All back, right. All right.
Bye bye.
Bye.
So yeah, the reality is that there's 50 things that all line up to make any one thing we try work. And so often we find that we're well behind the curve when it comes to try this, try that, try something else. That's the nature of troubleshooting. You know, we've been doing this for, I think, collectively 800 or 900 years. And we know a lot. But what we most know is that troubleshooting is a crapshoot. You know, you try something, it doesn't work, you try something else. You try something else, but you write it down. As Adam Savage's producer once said, the difference between science and screwing around is writing it down. And believe me, when that's true, that's particularly true about troubleshooting. You change one variable at a time, and you write down what you changed. And then you change it back, and you change another variable. That's really the only way to properly troubleshoot.
Never change two things at once, because you don't know what's going to, what happened and which change caused it.
Right. Particularly if neither one works. Now, did they conflict with each other? Would one of them have worked otherwise? It's hard to know. So, yeah, it's a troubleshooting is a long, painful process. All right, we got a couple of minutes. Let's head back to the phones and talk to Andy from Greece, New York. What's up, Andy?
Hi, guys. I've got an interesting problem in Linux. Went to put in some fonts, the Microsoft fonts, into LibreOffice. Hit the install button, it rolls right along, no problem. And all of a sudden, it pops up an end-user license agreement window. And I figured, okay. And I read down through it. Doesn't say anything about having to pay for it. It says it's free, but you agreed to do all this and that, and all the usual verbiage. And there's a little okay with, like, an arrow bracket around it, but it's not highlighted. It's not in different colors. It's black. You go to hit it, nothing happens. Now you've got this end user license window open, and it won't close.
and it's hijacked the Git app and locked it.
All right, what many of these end user license agreements does is they will not highlight the OK button until you have reached the bottom of the file. They want to assure that you have read the entire thing before you click OK.
Or at least scroll through it.
Or at least scroll through it.
Well, I did go all the way to the bottom, figuring that might be what it is, and I got all the way to the bottom, and I went back up, and the OK wasn't highlighted.
Sometimes I've seen one where you have to click a button inside the scroll window before you can click the OK button outside the scroll window.
Okay, I'll play with it. But I tried to say, and there are other problems with I was having with this install LibreOffice, so I said, okay, I'll just uninstall it, get it out of there, and put in a fresh copy. It won't hurt any, it doesn't touch my files or anything like that, so I can just bring it back in. And I go to uninstall it, and it's uninstalling, all of a sudden that end user license pops up, and it still won't let me get out of it. So now it's I can't finish uninstalling and reinstalling.
All right. Well, what are you trying to install it through LibreOffice or through some other program?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How are you trying to install these fonts? Through LibreOffice or through some other program?
Through Linux.
What's the command you're using?
I think it was just install. I went and looked for it, and there was a huge list of font libraries, and I went to the top, and this one was right at the top. So I just clicked it.
All right, there's a program called TTF-MSCoreFonts-Installer.
Yes.
And that's the program you clicked on.
Yes. And it gives me this end user license that just locks everything.
Hmm.
Now, I can go to the bottom and see if there's another button to press or something that I missed. But I did go all the way to the bottom. And I didn't see. I thought there might be a button down there to say finished or whatever. I didn't see anything. Nothing obvious anyway. And if I try and exit it, it gives me warning messages about continuing or canceling or whatever.
Right.
And when I try and uninstall it, I get all these dire warnings about don't stop the process, you'll hurt your install and all this other stuff. So I've gone out to ChatGPT and I said, how do I get rid of this? Or if this is locked up, what do I do? And it gave me a couple pages worth of stuff to look at. I got to do that this afternoon. But there's a gentle way to nudge this and a little bit strong way to do it, and then do this only as a last resort.
All right. Listen, we got to take a break. You can stay on the line or whatever you want to do, but we got to take a break.
I'll stay on the line.
Okay. The reality is that the first hour of this show is done, surprising me. It went very, very fast. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray. Look, don't go away. I'm Nick Francesco. Don't go too far. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. Grab yourself a little snack of some sort, but we'll be right back. Listen to the words of wisdom that are about to spew forth from your radio. And we will see you on the other side with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
Online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes, I got to look different places for the clock now. 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we still have Andy from Greece on the line. Andy, you still there?
I'm still here.
All right, let me ask you a question. When you see this end-user license agreement, is it a text document on kind of a purple background in a gray box?
Yeah, it's in a window.
Yeah. How are you trying to hit the OK button?
I've tried everything I can think of.
Tell me what you tried.
I put the cursor over it, and I tried hit enter. No, it didn't take it. Then I highlighted it and hit enter. That didn't do it. I looked all over to see if there was something that said, hit this key to OK, and there was nothing.
Have you tried hitting the tab key and seeing if it highlights in red?
No. I didn't know that was an option.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Yeah, sometimes the tab key moves between buttons on dialogues.
Right. So you're looking at what you're looking at is a text-based dialog box. Text-based dialog boxes, generally speaking, ignore the cursor. So you have to use text-based solutions to manage a text-based dialog box. And the way that they work is that you use the tab key to move among button choices. In this case, you only have one. So you would think it would be pre-highlighted, but no, it is not. So you have to hit the tab key, which then highlights the OK, generally speaking, in red. I won't promise it's in red. Then you can hit enter. And it should work.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate the information. I was listening earlier to some of the solutions you're offering. I'm in the process of trying to convert to Linux. It's not going as smoothly as I would have liked. And I've tried Wine, and that's a real monster. At least for me, it's not. I'm having very bad luck getting it to do anything. And I'm trying to read the instructions and watch videos and whatnot. It's not real simple.
Which program is this?
Wine.
Oh, Wine. Yeah. Well, yes. Theoretically, you just install it, and then when you run a Windows program, it finds it and uses it, but it almost never actually works that way. Listen, we got to move on. We got other people waiting on the line.
In this case, I can guarantee that it doesn't work that way. But anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
We going to be on for tomorrow night?
What?
Is the lounge on for tomorrow night?
It is. It is. Thank you.
All right.
It is.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. I should mention that every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m., we do the Soundbites Lounge almost every Sunday night. Last week I was dog sick thanks to Steve Ray, which is also why we didn't do the Wednesday one. But most Sunday nights from 9 to 10 p.m. And you find that out by going to soundbites.org/lounge. And if the lounge is up between 9 and 10 p.m., there will be a visible link that you can click on and join us. Everyone is welcome. You can lurk if you want to. No one is forced to turn on their microphone and or camera, but you can certainly do that if you want to. And you are welcome from 9 to 10 p.m. every Sunday night in the Soundbites Lounge at soundbites.org/lounge. And you can find the lounge link, by the way, on our website at soundbites.org. That is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And it is the very top link under some important links. That's how important it is. It's the very top one. All right, we're going back to the phones, and our next caller is Wayne from Henrietta, New York. What's up, Wayne?
Hello, guys. I was running into a confounding problem with logging into Office. I changed my password a couple weeks ago, and I was just going in to take advantage of this is on a Windows 10 machine, and I was going to take advantage of signing up for the free updates using Bing credits. And so when I opened my account, I booted into Windows. There was a notification that there was an error with my, it said Windows account, but I think it was actually Office account. Trying to go into Office, it won't log in with either my new or my used password, or my new or old password. If I try to log in to my account, it says, start off with saying something went wrong, which is a really useful error message. And if I go into both my Microsoft and my Office account online, it exists. But if I try to log in another way to my Office account, it says I don't have an account. So kind of in a quandary here.
All right, the first thing to try is the sign-in helper tool. Yes?
Okay, mm-hmm.
This sure. This happens so often that Microsoft has a sign-in helper tool that is designed to help you sign in to your Microsoft account. Oh, you know what? This actually gets to be kind of easy. I'm putting that into the chat with Steve. Steve can then put it into the link list, and you can head on over there from soundbites.org. Steve's going to put it up as a link. Notice I'm just assuming Steve is doing this because Steve is so efficient that he always does it before I can even talk about it. Now he of course has to do it.
Will that be under latest links heard on the show?
Yeah, it'll be under latest links heard on the show. And it is the Microsoft support. It's basically Microsoft, contact Microsoft support, and the choice you make is help me sign into my Microsoft account. And there is a Microsoft account sign-in helper. It is kind of ridiculous. I agree with you that this happens so often. They've actually got a function to deal with this, but it is true, and so that should be there in a couple of minutes.
Okay, one complicating issue with all this, that forever, this is a personal machine running Windows. It's my only remaining machine running Windows 10, not eligible for upgrade, but so it's a personal machine. However, I do occasionally log into my corporate email account.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
And using Outlook online. And every time I do that, it suddenly wants to take over my personal Office account with my corporate account. So it's constantly wanting to sign back in and out, even though I want it just to stay connected to my personal Office account. Because I go in and look at my Outlook account with my employer, that comes back.
Which what browser are you using?
I use a multitude of browsers. I use Firefox and Chrome. And
when you want to log into your corporate Microsoft account, because that's part of the problem. You log into your Microsoft account for the very first time, and it says, "Is this a enterprise corporate account, or did you make it yourself?" And if you say the wrong answer, you're screwed.
Oh boy, are you?
Yeah. So make a new profile in your browser for using the business account, and then have a separate
profile.
Or just
use a different browser.
Yeah, dedicate one browser to business and one browser to personal.
I never thought of that. That is a great idea. I will do that going forward.
Yeah, what's happening is the cookies are getting mixed, and it's getting confused as to which account to use.
But if you use two different browsers, then the cookies don't mix. Never mix, never worry.
Okay, so the apparently I shot myself in the foot trying to fix this. So the when that link comes up, it'll probably have what I need unless it's already there.
So the way to fix that is you go into whichever browsers you're using, and you go into. I'm sorry. What?
I'm just sorry. It came in live. I see the link. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
All right. I was going to say what you do is you go into your browser under cookies and delete the Microsoft cookies.
Okay.
Now when you go to sign in again, it's going to think you're brand new and you give it the right account and the right information and you're in. And then on the other one, do the same thing. You give it the other account and the other information and you're in, and never the twain shall meet.
So this answers a question I've had for years. why that was causing the problem, and I cannot be the only person who encounters that. So,
that's why Microsoft has a whole how to fix my login helper. It's ridiculous. When you have that problem so often that you actually have to write a program to fix it, maybe you should fix it at the other end.
Well,
yeah. That's
all right, amazing. We good?
I'm sure this will work. Thank you so much. You have a great rest of the day.
Good luck. Good luck. It's Microsoft, so we're not promising anything actually works. It's just, I get it. Microsoft assumes the only things you ever do are in Microsoft, and they also assume you only have one account. So when you do non-Microsoft things or you have more than one Microsoft account, Microsoft doesn't know how to handle that. So doing it in different browsers, or as Steve said, in different profiles, but it's a whole lot easier just use two different browsers. And a lot safer because there's no possible way they'll mix. No possible way. You're better off. I think you're just better off that way. So I would suggest that you do that from now on. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Chuck from Penfield, New York. What's up, Chuck?
Hi, gentlemen. To address the earlier individual, and I got in a little late, so maybe you guys already addressed this, but Firefox has a mechanism for generating a profile manager. So you can set up a half a dozen different profiles for personal, business, job search, financial, whatever you want. And you can have all your cookies and all your tabs and everything else all separated.
Yep, that's absolutely true. And so does Chrome, and so does every other browser. And you can do that. I use a couple of my browsers. I have multiple profiles set up, and you just have to log out and log back in and change your browser, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Or it's just as easy if you have multiple browsers, which you're allowed to do, by the way.
Well,
the browsers you can fit in memory at once.
The same with Opera, but Opera's a little more squirrely about how to do it.
Yeah, but if you use, for example, Chrome and Firefox.
Yeah.
I use the two of those all day long. For example, under Firefox, I do Facebook, and I don't do that anywhere else, and I don't do anything else in Firefox because Facebook is always listening.
Yeah. Okay, anyway.
And it can't listen if I don't have anything over on the other side.
Okay, my question now. I've been dealing with something for the past month or so when I log in, or not log in, but I get a BIOS error. Error sending end of post message to ME, da 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 da. I'm trying to get around to, my thinking is it's possible that the BIOS got, I have the latest BIOS, this is an Asus motherboard. I've downloaded the BIOS, put it in a separate download directory. However, when I come up into the BIOS to get to the Asus, what do they call it, Easy BIOS or something like that to upgrade the directory, it doesn't show up there. It shows up when I go into Windows, and it shows up that the the downloaded file was there, and I've extracted it, and it's in the extracted directory. with the BIOS upgrade, but when I go back to the BIOS and try and access the directory from the disk, it still doesn't show that the directory nor the BIOS that I want to upgrade with. Got any suggestions?
Right, so who makes your computer?
Me. It's an Asus motherboard.
Asus. All right. So you've gone to the Asus website and downloaded the correct BIOS for that specific Asus motherboard.
Right, and put it in a given directory with the title and whatever.
And then when you go to install it, how are you installing it?
Well, I go
trying to install it.
I press F2, delete or whatever, get into the BIOS, and there's an easy BIOS update utility that's in there. And when you go to upgrade from the I've got this file on a disk somewhere, and you go to look at the disk where I have it, most of the directories that are on that disk are there, but the directory that I saved this to isn't. And that I'm scratching my head as to why I can see it in, and I can do a DOS window and see it in DOS. It's there, but in the BIOS where I need to get at it to bring it up and upgrade to BIOS, or not upgrade it, but just reinstall.
Right. Have you tried putting the new BIOS on a thumb drive?
No, I have tried making a new directory, and I put the file in a new directory. Now, I did see the new directory, but it didn't see the subdirectory that the expansion of the zip file created.
No, I understand that. I would suggest try putting it on a thumb drive.
On a disk drive? Oh, okay, and just put the whole thing in one, haul off the whole world and go from
right,
there.
Right up at the base. Don't
yeah.
put it in a subdirectory or anything.
Yep, right at the root. Yeah, and would that make... Am I making sense at what might be going on here with this ME can't install and...
Well, it is very possible that your BIOS is, in fact, corrupted.
Corrupted, okay.
Now, the
thinking.
Other thing is, you should be able to update the BIOS directly via Windows.
Nah, it can't find a directory. It can't find a path.
Again, don't...
Windows? Not in the BIOS. Within Windows?
Yeah, I'm talking about in Windows.
Okay. I log all the way on. Log all the way into Windows. I don't do this from BIOS.
Right.
Okay.
There's also something called My Asus.
Yeah, I've got that. Or an Asus Suite or something, Asus something.
I think it's My Asus.
Is it? Okay. I have an AI Suite. There might be another utility that was on that installation disk. I'll go out and see if I can find that. But I shouldn't have to do it. I should be able to do it from within Windows and not at the BIOS level.
Sometimes depends on the motherboard.
Okay.
Yes.
Put it on a flash drive at a root directory.
I don't know how you installed Windows, but generally speaking, when you install with an Asus motherboard, you get a program called My Asus in Windows.
Okay.
And you can do a search for that in the Windows search bar.
Okay.
And then if you have it, open it up and you may have to install it. There is a way to install it. I'm putting that in the thing for Steve to see now.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's for both Windows 11 and Windows 10. There are options on how to do that.
Okay.
Once you're in My Asus, you look for the system update tab.
Yeah.
And if you don't see a system update tab, means it doesn't support the feature.
Okay.
And now we have to move on for something else. But generally speaking, most of them will have
a
system update.
And
one of the choices under system update is BIOS update.
Yeah. Okay. Real good. Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Okay. Yep. Bye.
The beauty of many of the current motherboard systems is that they have Dell, HP, Asus. You can go to their websites and type in your motherboard, or if you bought the system from them, you can type in the serial number, whatever, And you can then see all of the things that are available for you, for updates for you, for drivers for you, for whatever you need from that. And that's one of the many reasons that many people prefer to buy from Dell or HP or Asus. That's a real nice feature there. All right, we're going back to the phones, and we're going back to Fred from Rochester. What's up, Fred?
Oh, a whole bunch of things, but some of them you can help with and some of them you can't. I did get my Raspberry Pi 5, and it was absolutely simple to put together and simple to start up. The only shortcoming that I'm finding so far is the Bluetooth transmitter is a little bit on the weak side. I can transmit if I'm a few feet away. I have trouble if I'm putting more than one, if I've got a Bluetooth keyboard, Bluetooth mouse, and a Bluetooth speaker. The Bluetooth speaker keeps cutting out. Or if I get more than about 15 feet away, or if I go around the corner into another room. So I'm looking at adding external Bluetooth device or Bluetooth sender. Transmitter, and I'm not finding concrete evidence that that particular one will work with the Pi. I see some of them that specifically say does not work on Linux. Any recommendations? Any list that you could post on your web page, newsletter, or any other form would be fabulous.
Yeah, I've seen, okay, so I've seen problems with many of the dongles that are available. I've seen problems with them. So here's an issue. Have you looked at the congestion of the channel you're using for Bluetooth, of the Bluetooth itself?
No.
How congested it is?
No.
The Bluetooth shares the 2.4 gigahertz band with other Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So if your 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi is particularly loud, it will interfere with the Bluetooth 2.4 gigahertz on your Raspberry Pi.
Okay. So would the phone's Bluetooth be the same frequency?
Yes. Bluetooth is Bluetooth.
There's multiple channels within the Bluetooth that they can share. And if you have two devices that are on channels too close together, they can interfere with each other.
Well, what my only comparison that I can give you is on my phone, I can go anywhere in my apartment and listen in to your program with my phone sitting on my desk in the other room. With the Pi, the same speaker. If I noticed some glitches, like if I turn on the mouse or I do something with the mouse, it starts doing skipping. So I had it on, I was listening to a program, and I just kept walking away, slowly, stop, listen. And when I got to about 15 feet, 17 feet, somewhere in that neighborhood, it started cutting out. And as soon as I went around the corner of the room, it died completely, but that does not happen with my phone transmitter. So I'm guessing that the Pi's transmitter may not be as powerful, or because it's buried, it's a small little tiny thing buried in the bottom of the Pi package. So that's why I thought, well, maybe I'd just try a different transmitter, but I'm trying to find one that will be compatible. I wouldn't be against it. As a matter of fact, I think I'm in favor of one that's actually got an external antenna. But all the things that I spent copious amount of time researching and listening to and whatever, reading, didn't give me any definitive answers. So I figured that, you know, one of you guys that's doing a lot of stuff with pies probably tried one particular brand or another, and it worked. I don't care if, you know, it's the best or the worst or the whatever. If it works for you, it'll probably work for me.
Well, yeah, the part of the problem is that the Bluetooth in your...
Yep, 1 minute.
Okay. Hold on. Stay on the line, Fred. We got to take a quick break back in just a... No?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Fred from Rochester, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. It is Soundbites. It is member-supported. Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Fred from Rochester on the line. Okay, so Fred.
Yes.
I've been doing some research.
Okay.
Oh, that's why I can't hear anybody. I turned the sound down. That's it. I've been doing a little research, and it turns out that there is indeed a problem with the Bluetooth module in the Raspberry Pi 5.
Okay.
And Raspberry Pi folks say they are working on it.
Huh.
Whatever that actually means. But they are working on it, so I guess we all just kind of wait. I mean, you would think they would have solved it by now, but no.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, external plug-in...
I've been searching the web again, and there are 50 people who will tell you 50 different things. So here's my suggestion: Bluetooth dongles are cheap. Feel free to buy one from Amazon. If it doesn't work, return it. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for you than that. The other question is, what's going on in your neighborhood? The 2.4 gigahertz band. How full is it? What's in between you and the thing? I know that it works with your phone, but a phone generally has a much higher powered Bluetooth than the Raspberry Pi's low energy Bluetooth.
Right. Yeah, I have Bluetooth on my Intel Nook, which is the machine that I have for Windows. I have an HP desktop. That's got an external Bluetooth, TP-Link Bluetooth. I could steal that out of there and try it, but I haven't done it yet because I'm still using that device. And I also noticed that the Raspberry Pi, I installed the LibreOffice on it, just playing with what it'll do.
Sure.
And I notice when I've got the LibreOffice page open and a wired mouse plugged in, it's kind of slow coming up on the LibreOffice page, and the mouse pointer starts getting kind of funky. I move and it doesn't move, and then I move again and it moves too far, and that kind of glitchiness. But that's the only, that's a couple of things. But once I get it to do what I want it to do and it's set, then I won't mess with it after that. But at least that particular one, because it'll be, as I've said before, I have a particular purpose for it. I want it to run my Pandora, and I'd like to have it go to a old school receiver amplifier, and two, clips, speakers and be my music for the house.
Sure.
But until I get it somewhat figured out and get the Bluetooth working sufficient to go across the room without hiccuping, then I can't permanently install that.
Right. Well, try a different try a USB dongle from one of your other systems. You know, shut it down for 15 minutes and give it a shot, see what happens. It's a test. And then you'll know. I wish I had a better answer for you, but I don't.
So if I take it out of the HP, because the HP is a refurbished machine that did not have Bluetooth, so I have a dongle on that machine, I should shut that machine down before unplugging it?
Yeah, that would be best.
Okay, and shutting down the Pi before plugging in?
Absolutely.
Okay. I will do that and try to continue to listen to you on another device.
Thank you, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Yeah, I've got a Pi 500 that I haven't set up yet. Pi 5, I mean. There is now a Pi 500, by the way, which is like the Pi 400. It's a Pi 5 inside a keyboard. So you actually get the keyboard. And all you have to do is plug in a mouse and a monitor, and you've got a working system. I have a 400 that works just beautifully, and I suspect the 500 works as well. But yeah, so I haven't had time to set that up. I just haven't had time. Oh, I had time this week, but I was sick, so I didn't do anything there. Yeah, it's pretty good. All right, back to the phones. Assuming I can find that thing. Our next caller is Brian from Pavilion, New York. What's up, Brian?
Some people call it Pavilion. We call it Pavilion. It's wonderful up here.
Do you?
But anyway. Yeah. Oh, actually... one suggestion, I'm a Pi veteran. One thing you want to try before you get all hammered out of shape and swapping stuff out is just do a better power supply on them, because the power supplies that come with those are junk.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, because I've had multiple Pis for 2 through 5, and each one I just use an old like a laptop power supply, and it cures cancer for those things.
Wow. Yeah, so just, it's not going to provide, well, of course, it still provides the 5 volt, 5 amp, whatever it is, 5 volt, 2 amp, mm-hmm. whatever it is, 220, 221, whatever it takes. So you just use any power supply that takes that ends up with a USB.
Yeah, I had a Chromebook that fried, and I kept that power supply. It wasn't a power supply, the book, the actual computer fried. I put the power supply from that on my Pi 4. I used to have problems with it driving the sound, and
yeah.
I never used Wi-Fi on it. But I use Wi-Fi, but not Bluetooth. And I had all kinds of no end of trouble with it. As soon as I plugged that in, the thing just woke right up and ran perfectly until, of course, that fried. But, you know.
Well, they do. That's an excellent thought, Brian. Thank you.
Oh, sure. I do that all the time.
Yes, you do.
I'm just kidding. But, no. You guys, listen to you every week. It's a rare Saturday I get to call in. But I do listen on the radio. There's that old-fashioned radio thing. It's a plastic box with a speaker in it. And
Wow, you're old, Brian.
Oh, yes. I know. So, all right, guys. Well, take care.
All right. Thank you, Brian. That's an excellent point. And I've got a couple of those old Chromebook power supplies sitting around. Maybe I'll swap out a couple of my power supplies on my other devices and see how they work. That's an interesting idea. I like that idea. I like it. I like it a lot. All right, should I be reading a news item? Is that what this is?
Yeah, let's do that.
Microsoft, Google, or miscellany?
Well, we did Microsoft, so let's do Google.
All right, Google it is. And I'm going to change my glasses before I do this. I'm fine. My eyes are old. I have a pair of glasses for the computer, and when I try to read actual text on them, I have to hold the text way out here, so I'll just put on my regular ones. For those of you who like to stream music through your phone while using Google Maps, you may be out of luck for now. Google Maps is incredibly popular on both Android and iOS phones, and is a very high-end, and a very high-end percentage of people who use it also use it to stream music on long commutes. Surprisingly, the music playback controls went missing in the latest update. Remain calm, citizen. Google has noted that it is aware of this horrible problem. A Google spokesrobot said we are actively working on to fix an issue that is affecting media playback controls on Google Maps, so chill out. I don't know what kind of an issue that would be other than they took it out, and now they're going to put it back. That's the issue. After months of testing, Google is finally widely rolling out a button for AI mode directly in the search box on Google's homepage on Google.com. Along with AI results being first in the results list, this is a pretty big deal. Google, like everybody else in the tech industry, has jumped all in on AI. It's unclear how this will affect their ad revenue, but it's sure to have some impact. More importantly, it's sure to have a proportionally higher impact on the revenue of sites that rely on Google ad revenue. Speaking of which, Google search results have undergone a seismic shift over the last year as AI fever has continued to escalate among the tech giants. Nowhere is this change more apparent than right at the top of Google's storied results page, which is now home to AI overviews. Google contends these Gemini-based answers don't take traffic away from websites, but a new analysis by the Pew Research Center says SEO experts have disagreed with Google's stance on how AI affects web traffic. And the newly released Pew collected a study backs them up. The Pew Research Center analyzed data from 900 users of the Ipsos Knowledge Panel collected in March of 2025. The analysis shows that among the test group, users were much less likely to click on search results when the page included an AI overview. Pew reports that searches without an AI answer resulted in a click rate of 15%. On searches with AI overviews, the rate of clicks to other sites dropped by almost 8%. And perhaps more troubling, Google users are more likely to end their browsing session after seeing an AI overview. That suggests that many people are seeing information generated by a robot, and their investigation stops there. Unfortunately for these people, all forms of generative AI are prone to hallucinations, lying, that caused them to provide incorrect information. So more people could be walking away from a search with the wrong information. Continuing its AI rampage, Google is following through on recent promises to add more generative AI features to its photos and video products. Over on YouTube, Google is rolling out the first wave of generative AI video for YouTube Shorts. But even if you're not a YouTuber, you'll be exposed to more AI videos soon. Google Photos, which is integrated with virtually every Android phone on the market, is also getting AI video generation capabilities. In both cases, the features are currently based on the older Veo 2 model, not the more capable Veo 3 that has been blazing across the internet since it was announced at I.O. in May. We're not AI yet. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll-free 800-790-0415. It's AI everywhere. You cannot turn around without seeing it, which leads us into the middle of next month, where I have been forced against both my better judgment and my will into giving a talk at Apple Cider about AI.
Wednesday, August 13th at 7 p.m.
Whether I want to, it'll be wonderful. We'll talk about various things that you should know about AI. We'll also talk about various different AI models that are out there. And if you've got an extra fairly powerful machine lying around unused, you can run AI locally without in any way sharing that information with the internet. So that's all out there and available. Although I will say, just as a sneak preview, golly, it's frustrating. About half the time, and maybe it's me. Maybe I'm not. I have not learned how to craft my prompts well. But I often get wrong answers. I often, and then when you say, I had one, where I asked it something, it gave me an utterly incorrect answer. I pointed out that feature does not exist, so that stopped telling me that feature, and it said, "You're absolutely right. Here's the right way to do this," and it gave me the exact same feature again, and it did that four times.
Persistently wrong.
Just gave up. What?
Persistently wrong.
It's not just wrong. It's proudly wrong. It's persistently wrong. It is doubling down on its wrongness every single time.
I wonder if the drop in click-through rate on AI searches was because it's, oh, crap, an AI again, and left. Not that they got the answer they were looking for.
I will say that, I listen to a bunch of YouTube videos, and whenever one comes up with an AI voice, unless I'm desperately interested in the subject, I turn it off.
And a lot of times it's the same voice.
It's the same voice every time. I don't like that person. I don't want to hear that voice. Excuse me.
But your voice is just so melodious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or malodorous, one of those.
Malodorous, I'll go with. Absolutely. But there's not, it's just, it's not right. It's, and okay, in some cases I get it. If a person has some problem with speech, a speech impediment, or they don't speak, then the AI-generated voice can be a godsend. If English is not that person's first language and they are in some way ashamed, although they shouldn't be, that they don't speak good English, then using AI can be good. Although I will say that I have nothing but respect to someone who speaks more than one language. They went out and learned a second language. I've tried learning other languages. I just stink at it. I know a lady who knows seven languages. English is her seventh language. I have nothing but respect for that woman. Holy moly. I have enough trouble learning English and Latin, although Latin doesn't help me much these days. I got to be honest.
It's always crazy how people will... They're proud they only speak one language, and it's your fault for not understanding my language.
I used to make a joke in class that you know, when somebody would be reluctant to speak, I would tell them, you know, you speak more than one language, and I have nothing but respect for that. I'm an American. We don't learn foreign languages. We just scream until you get it.
Well, yeah. We all learn foreign languages in high school and then promptly forget them.
I had trouble. I learned a little bit of Latin, mainly because the teachers at the seminary were adamant that I learn Latin, and we did immerse ourselves in it, so it was a little more useful. But I tried learning German. I tried learning Italian. My parents spoke Italian. It doesn't sit in my head. It just, languages don't sit in my head.
Well, I think a lot of that is because of the immigrants, 100 years ago. They wanted their kids immersed in English and didn't want them learning the old language. Partly so they could yell at the kid behind their back and they wouldn't understand it. But now, that raised a generation of kids that were English only.
The only time my father ever took his belt to me was when I asked to learn Italian. He said, "You're an American, you will speak English." And I think that set it in my brain.
Yeah.
Because when he was a kid, he was laughed at for his accent. And so he spent a lot of time losing it and decided that I would speak English. Dang it. Although he did not say dang it. But yeah, so yes. And I believe that, you know, at a very early age, that sort of made my brain. Now, I tried programming languages all day long.
Yeah, I tried to get my college to accept my 7 or 8 programming languages as my foreign language requirement for my liberal arts degree, and they never did.
Yep, yep. I can learn programming languages all day long. But real languages, I can't do it. I don't know. It's weird. These days, of course, being able to speak multiple programming languages is far more important to me than being able to speak multiple human languages. But I still wish I had that facility. You know, somebody was saying, you know, they speak French. And I said, that's great. And they said, it's not that big a deal. 4-year-olds in France can do it. Thank you. That made me feel so much better. But yeah. But I have to say, was it Brian who was saying, yeah, use a better power supply. That's a brilliant idea because in many cases, even, you know, when you get the power supply for a Raspberry Pi, it's really designed to power the Raspberry Pi. Now you're done. It's not designed for high-end use. So if you put a load on your Raspberry Pi, it's not, you know, and part of that is that's how they keep the cost down, right? But if you've got a couple of old USB power supplies sitting around, like from a Chromebook, I'm looking at one right now under my desk. It would boost the power of not the actual draw, but what's available. So you don't pull down anything bad, you know, and you don't pull down the draw far enough that things can't work right. Yeah. So yeah, that's a really interesting thought. I may have to play with that. I have to swap out my USB anyway. UPS, I mean. My UPS glitched, and it's the second time. It's a 5-year-old UPS uninterruptible power supply. It's 5 years old, and it only had a 3-year warranty. So I bought a new one. It's on its way, and I'll be replacing that. One of the things that we tend to forget is that the power that comes through our plugs in our walls, the mains, as our friends in England call them, is dirty. It's often filthy. And so if you've got the ability to buy an uninterruptible power supply, cleans up, and you get the right one. The one I've got always powers the battery, and the battery always powers the computer.
Yeah, a lot of people see, you know, the wall outlet's 110 volts. Well, it's between 108 and 118, fluctuating all the time.
Yep, yep. So this one stays between 120 and 123. Right now it's at 120, which is exactly where you want it. Every once in a while it pops up a little bit, but that's it. But I'm going to replace it and get a newer power supply. It's exactly the same model. It's a trip light. It's a really nice one. And it provides about 2.5 hours of power with the two machines and the monitor I've got plugged into it. So, and it used to work really, really well. but it's 5 years old and it's glitched twice now. And that's one time too many. So I've bought a new one and I will be replacing that as soon as it shows up. All right. That music tells us we are done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright. I particularly want to thank Steve Ray, who just once again worked magic to make me available from home. Thank you, Steve. Well done. I want to thank everybody who called in, particularly those of you who answered questions we didn't answer right or didn't even think to ask, like Brian's answer about power supplies. But we are done for this week. You can find a whole bunch of links on our link list. Join us tomorrow night at 9 p.m. in the Soundbites Lounge. And we will be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We'll see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?